Started a little bit earlier, just because you know how these sea captains like to rabbit on. If you have cell phones, please turn them off or mute them. And just a couple quick notes about upcoming events. On Thursday, we have what should be a fun lunch. We're calling it Webb v. Jake, which sounds like an important Supreme Court case. In fact, it's David Webb going up against Jake Vanderkamp. They're going to debate the extension to the blackout period. That's on Thursday. Sign up if you haven't. And next Monday, Yasheng Huang, a very well-known academic at MIT who's recently written a very well-received book on China's economy. That's on the following Monday. Today's speaker, you've probably seen the bio that we send out with these events. That's the boring version. Let me tell you the other version about Cameron. He's arriving in Hong Kong much as he arrived in Hong Kong in similar to fashion as he's about to leave it. He showed up in the South China Morning Post business section in November of 2005 for a job interview. The business editor at the time was away on vacation. I was the deputy business editor, so I had to sit down and have a chat with him. I looked at his resume. He'd worked for Reuters in Singapore doing markets coverage, so I knew he could string together a subject, a verb, and an object without any problem. I also noticed he sailed halfway around the world, and I thought that was more interesting than talking about Reuters and this markets job we had going. So we spent about 45 minutes talking about sailing. When the business editor, Simon Pritchard, got back the next week, I told him, "You got to hire this guy. He sailed halfway around the world." Simon called him in. They had another 45-minute talk about sailing, and he got the job. A month later, Simon and I were sacked, basically, and we abandoned Cameron. I did make it up to him, though, because when a job came up at the FT, I mentioned it to him. Told the editors he would be a good candidate for it. He came in. He impressed them. The Asia editor at the time, Victor Mallet, was a very keen sailor. So Cameron came in and talked to him about sailing. But he had a bit of an attack of the conscience, which was he knew that there was this expedition coming up. This is going back to last summer. And he felt a little bit guilty about signing on with the FT when the editors didn't realize there was a good chance that he was going to head north pretty soon. So he asked me about that and said, "Well, you know, really, shouldn't I tell him?" And they're not in the room here today, so I told them, "No, just screw him, take the job, and then bugger off in 6 months," which is what he's doing. It's quite fun watching him at the office now. Sometimes we have to go up and ask him to, you know, to correct the mistakes he's edited into my story, or change the crap headline he's put on a story. And you go up to him, and you don't see the FT's editorial system up there. You'll see maybe a nautical chart, and he's quickly, you know, alt tabbing between his expedition and FT work. Although my favorite day, as I remember, he was on the phone to his fixer in the harbor over in Vancouver, and speaking none too softly, saying, no, the bolt's in the wrong position, the bolt's in the wrong position, you got to orientate it this way," and went over, and sure enough, there on his screen is a big picture of this bolt, which his man in the harbor is working on. So he spent a lot of time on this expedition recently. I've probably gone on long enough. There's an interesting backstory to how a Canadian prairie boy who grew up about as far as you can grow up from an ocean became such a keen sailor. But maybe we'll leave that for later. Needless to say, it had something to do with the girls on the beach of Lake Michigan that he wanted to get to know. Sorry, Jackie. Anyway, Cameron, floor is yours. Thanks.
Thank you. You were much kinder than I expected, Tom. Thank you very much for being here and showing interest in this project. I have bored many a person, I'm sure, with hours of prattling on about it in recent months. And I'm very happy to see that there's some fresh faces here for me to attack with this story. What I want to do today is just kind of go through some of the basics of the expedition and then leave some time for questions. There's some sailors and some Canadians and some journalists in the room, so I'm suspecting that there'll be some questions. So first of all, I want to kind of start out by telling you about where we're going. We're going to the Canadian Arctic. And ice is a very, very important feature of the Canadian Arctic because the animals and the people that live there use the ice as their living platform. And this is very central to really the theme of the whole project. The ice and the disappearance of this ice and how that affects the Arctic and the people that live there. There's about 130,000 people living in the Canadian Arctic. There's a lot of space for them. They can spread out. So it's a fairly remote place, and that's part of the challenge, obviously. There's only 6 weeks of summer, and we're going there during the summer. And the conditions, even though it'll be summer, it won't be warm and balmy. It's very, very far away from the Hong Kong climate. Average temperatures for July are plus 12 Celsius. That's when we'll be entering. Late July is when we'll be entering the Arctic. August, plus 10 Celsius. September, when we'll be exiting the Arctic and coming down the Davis Strait, which I'll illustrate later on, it'll be plus 2 Celsius. And if you imagine that, out on a boat in blowing wind and spray, it's very uncomfortable sailing conditions. And people ask me why on earth I go there, and I guess the best answer is because not many other people do, and the journalist in you tells you that that's probably where there's a good story. Although we're going there up there at summertime, it is still the Arctic, and ice is still the name of the game, even in summertime. The people in the Arctic are called the Inuit. In the U.S. and Alaska, they're called Eskimo, but in Canada, we call them Inuit. And there's approximately about 45,000 Inuit in all of Canada. About half of those live in the Arctic. So that's around 25,000 out of the 130,000 people living in the Arctic are Inuit, who are the aboriginals of the Arctic. Now, these people have been undergoing a very, very fast evolution in the past 50 years. They don't live in igloos anymore. They don't use dog sled teams all the time anymore. But the ice and the place they live, the land on which they live, is still a very important part of their culture. And there is a renewed desire amongst them to recapture the culture that has been lost in the last 50, 60 years of modernization. So it's a very interesting group of people that are very aware of their past and eager to recapture some of that and save what is left. Now, the Northwest Passage is the link between the Arctic and what I'm doing, and this is the link between, in geographical terms, it's the link between the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans, and this is really what interests me and interests the expedition. If you look at the chart on the screen, the Northwest Passage is often measured from the Arctic Circle on the west side between Alaska and Russia, and the Arctic Circle on the east side in the Davis Strait, and it's about 4,000 nautical miles. It's a waterway between the two oceans, as I mentioned, and it's become very, very symbolic of what's happening in the Canadian Arctic and what's happening with climate change. There's a huge sovereignty issue surrounding the Northwest Passage now. It runs through Canadian territory, and Canada has a very strong claim on it. But the U.S., Russia, Norway, Denmark all have their arguments why they should be able to send their vessels through it without notifying Canada. Right now, Canada has a voluntary registration system, which is helping to lay their claim on the passage. But this issue is far from over, and this is something that we'll be exploring on the expedition. The Northwest Passage is also a very historic route, and people kind of ask me, you're in Hong Kong, why are you planning an expedition in northern Canada? And I don't have a good answer for that, but I have a good excuse, and that is the Kellet Island, which is home to the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club. Kellet was a captain, a British sea captain, who was sent out to the Northwest Passage to go look for Franklin. That's the closest link I have to the Northwest Passage from Hong Kong. But obviously, the Canadian Arctic is always on the Canadian mind. It's very part of the very big part of the Canadian culture and psyche. And so, even though I'm living in Hong Kong, as a Canadian, Northwest Passage holds special allure for me. But there's a great amount of history associated with the passage. Briefly, Franklin was probably one of the most famous explorers who went up there and lost his life trying to find the passage in the 1800s. He failed, and they had to wait until 1906 until a Norwegian sailed through on a 90-foot sailing yacht. It took him 3 years. He got through and found that the passage did exist. By then, the British Navy had lost many a good man, many a good ship, and lost the race, in a sense, as well. However, all those explorers, they were the ones that charted the Arctic. They were the ones that named the islands, gave the islands and straits European names, and they played a very big role. And I was just in Victoria last week speaking to an ice captain, and he's the head of the Canadian Coast Guard for the Pacific. And he told me that, he warned me, he said, the charts are pretty wild up there. He said, you don't rely on your charts too much. He goes, keep your depth sounder on. He goes, because if you get off the main, from the Northwest Passage, the route that all the boats take, he goes, if you get a couple miles off of that, he goes, you're working on data that was produced by people in Franklin's era. And that is still the case. The charts that were made then are the ones that we rely on today, because there's just not a lot of traffic, there's not a lot of need. The timing of this expedition is dictated by ice in more ways than one. In the broader sense, we wouldn't be going there if climate change was not melting the ice of the Arctic. And until a few years ago, planning an expedition like this in a fiberglass boat would have been absolutely nuts. Now it's just mad. Then it would have been really, really nuts. And it's only because of climate change and the melting ice that we can really consider this and look at this as a viable project for one summer, one season, one melting season. Obviously, there's still ice up there in summer, even when there is increased melting. Some people ask me, well, will all the ice be gone in summertime? No, not at all. There will be a lot of ice flows. And this ice will be pushed back and forth by the wind. So our progress will be very much dictated by where the ice is, where the wind is blowing the ice that is there and that's floating on the sea. So often when you go sailing, you're at the mercy of the wind. This time we're really at the mercy of the ice, and that'll be the factor that determines whether or not we're successful. It's a very, very challenging voyage. There's going to be four people on a very small 40-foot boat. Weather will be very difficult, wet, cold, very unpredictable. The captain that I spoke to in Victoria, who goes by the nickname Duke said, the only thing you can assume about the Arctic is that it will always surprise you, again and again and again. And this is a man that has sailed through the passage twice, has lived in the Arctic, and is a ice boat captain. And he said, don't assume anything. The best predictions will always end up being wrong. So, poor charting. What did I do? There we go. Poor charting, cold weather, wet conditions will make for a very interesting sail. This is the Silent Sound. This is the yacht I bought this last summer. I actually bought it when I was in the interview process with the FT, when in my break between SCMP and the FT. I was busy in Canada closing the deal on my first yacht. I'm very proud of her. She's old, she's heavy, she's slow, and safe. She's not a racing yacht. Very small rig, big fuel tanks, big water tanks, 40 horsepower diesel engine, shallow draft of 5'6" draft. Accommodates four people comfortably, but not a lot more. It's a cutter rig sloop for anybody out there that doesn't recognize that. And she's in Victoria being refitted. New electronics, new satellite gear, GPS gear, new sails, everything that I can't afford. We're going up with the danger well in mind, buying all the safety gear that we think is proper. Here you get a picture of an immersion suit. We bought one of these for every crew. They're pretty costly, about $1,000 US a piece. But I was warned that if you're going to the Arctic and going sailing in the Arctic, And if you're taking a life raft, and if you're not taking survival suits, you're wasting your money on the life raft because you're not going to make it into the life raft. You're not going to survive in the life raft. So we bought these survival suits. And there's also a lot of other gear on board. Obviously, harnesses, life rafts, EPIRB, which is a beacon system. The boat is well equipped with safety gear, far beyond what the law requires and far beyond what normal coastal sailing would require, but for good reason, I believe. This is the interior of the boat. It's approximately 12 square meters, 12 if you measure by Hong Kong standards and include the windowsills. And we're sharing that with four people. Everybody has their own berth, just. It's actually quite comfortable. There's the silver, the heater you see there, that's a diesel-fired furnace. We have a water heater, which raises the temperature of the water from bone-chilling to mildly invigorating. And the boat has a full galley and a lot of storage space for provisions and camera gear. On to the crew. As you know, Tom introduced me. I've got a fair bit of offshore sailing experience, about 17,000 miles of nautical miles of offshore experience, plus many thousand miles of inshore experience. A lot of that has been yacht racing, offshore yacht racing, and here in Hong Kong, coastal racing. And I'll be leading the expedition as the captain of the boat and also in a research capacity. Elaine Chua is a well-known Singaporean sailor. She sailed solo. She sailed a 21-foot boat single-handed across the Atlantic in 2005 in the mini transit race. She's a very tough woman, and she's my first mate. And she will be taking charge of the boat when I'm otherwise engaged with research or filing reports via satellite, all these sort of things. She'll be my constant fallback as far as piloting the boat and making sure that we're safe. Tobias Neuberger is a doctor, a German doctor. He's recently moved from Istanbul back to Frankfurt. I like to tell people about how I met Tobias. I met him on a highway in South Africa. I had a map and he didn't. And he saw me stopped. I wasn't lost. I was just looking where I was. And I was looking at my map and he saw that I had a map and he stopped and asked if he could look at it. And we became very good mates. And so he's coming along as the ship's doctor. And I hope we don't need those talents of his, but he has many other talents that he brings. He has a business background. He's bringing some of that. He's really helped me kind of structure some of the project. He's also a very artistic fellow, a very good photographer, and so he brings a lot of different talents to the project, and we'll be relying on him pretty heavily for those. This is Anna Wolch. She is the newest member of the team. I just confirmed her on Sunday. She's our filmmaker. She's a Montreal-based French-Canadian filmmaker, immigrated from Poland as a teenager. She's done some beautiful, beautiful film work in Canada, sponsored by the Canadian government, a lot of it. And she's going to be coming along to document the entire expedition. And she's got a big project on her hands because usually if you look at doing something like this, you'd have a sound person, you'd have producers, you'd have a whole crew with you. She's on her own. And she's going to have to cook one day out of four and helm. A couple hours out of every day. So she's going to have a pretty big big project in her hands, but I have full confidence in her. So that's our crew, myself, Elaine, Tobias, and Anna. We also have a very large shore crew, and I'd like to add that these are all volunteers. I'm not paying anybody. They're having to come on their own accord. And this is Troy Dunkley. He's designed our website. The website has played a very, very big role in our marketing, obviously, and getting the word out there. Traffic on the website has been growing very, very rapidly. And he's done an excellent job of designing the site and kind of designing the whole look of the expedition and making it look like more than one farm boy from Manitoba on a sailing project. This is Chris Pilau. She is an 85-year-old scientist based on Vancouver Island. I was reading books about the Arctic going back to 2004, which is when this dream kind of started taking shape. And every book I read, I'd flip to the back, and in the bibliography would be this book called Naturalist Guide to the Arctic by Dr. Chris Pilau. So I bought it. I figured, well, everybody's reading it. Everybody's been using it for research. I'll do the same. Read it. It's beautifully illustrated by herself. Really excellent naturalist guide to the Arctic, exactly what it says it is. And then I contacted her and ended up going and visiting her. And she's this really amazing, dynamic, incredibly intelligent, enthusiastic environmentalist that has been to the Arctic 20 times, has written some of the most important books on Arctic nature and what's happening up there. And she's a very, very passionate environmentalist and climate change expert. She's exactly 50 years older than me to the day. And I was very keen to have her on board. Our crew is quite young. I would say we're quite young. Everybody's between the ages of 30 and 35. And having an 85-year-old on shore advising us and telling us what we're seeing and putting that into scientific context and just giving us, keeping us real in a sense, I thought was a really good chance. And she was very glad to take the opportunity. And she'll be doing some guest blogging on the site as well, which I think is going to be really interesting. To kind of between our hysteria and oh my God, my socks are wet blogs, she'll be putting some stuff up there that's a little more serious and scientific. This is Drew Feldman. Drew is an LA-based filmmaker. He was at first meant to come on the expedition, was very keen, was one of the first people signed up to come, and he was going to be coming along as the documentary maker. Unfortunately, other professional opportunities came up, and he's chosen those instead. However, he remains part of the shore team, and he'll be part of the post-production of the documentary. And we have a PR person, a journalist getting a PR person on board. Imagine that. This is Trisha Shears. She's a really good friend of mine from Canada, been a PR person for many, many years, and she'll be on site at the expedition launch, and that's assuming we're going to get a lot of media attention. So that's the team. Why are we doing all of this? When I started planning this expedition, a lot of people said, well, you're not taking any scientists along. What scientific studies are you doing? The answer is none. And because I believe as a journalist that we can tell the story of how climate change is affecting communities in the Arctic, and we can tell that story in a way that isn't told regularly. Scientists are producing excellent reports, very important data that we really need. However, people read these stories in the newspaper and they read about how many square kilometers of ice are being lost, the numbers of wildlife that are being lost, and this, you become a bit numb to these professional reports, these experts sitting in Ottawa or Vancouver or some university telling you about what's happening. Our goal is to go up there and hear the stories of the people that live there and hear them as, you know, the grassroots stories, how their hunting habits are changed. What happens to their social fabric when climate change is removing half the platform on which they lived and hunted over thousands of years? How does it change their houses? Or some of their houses are sinking into the ground. Maybe there's some good stories. I'm hoping that they're not all sob stories. I think there's going to be some stories of people saying, climate change is the best thing that ever happened to me. I've got all these Southerners coming up here and they need to be guided around. Maybe there's people creating businesses out of it. I don't know. I have an idea that there's going to be a lot of very interesting stories from the people that live there telling me how this affects them. And then we want to come back and tell that story to more people. And we want to do that through a film documentary. I plan to do magazine articles, newspaper articles. I'm taking freelance commissions for those. And we're going to be doing, Tobias is planning some art exhibitions. And we want to tell this story in a creative way that highlights this whole story to people that might not pick up a newspaper and read about sovereignty issues in Canada, and they might not read scientific reports, but they might watch a documentary, they might go watch a film or read a book about a sailing adventure that has an interesting reportage angle to it. So that's our mission, and we want to tell the story. Obviously, it's going to be factually based. That's why we have Chris along. Chris as our shore-based scientific advisor. But we want to tap into the kind of the emotions and the creative minds of people with our story. That's the end of my prepared presentation, and I'd be very happy to take any questions.
Cameron, thanks very much. You want to come back and sit here, and we'll run through the Q&A. Right here, please.
Hi, my name is John Antweiler. I'm a banker. I'm just wondering how often you anticipate putting in to shore.
Here we go. There's about 10 communities that we've kind of targeted that we really want to visit. It may be a bit more, maybe a few less. As I mentioned, the ice will be dictating our pace a lot. So sometimes we might have a week in a port, and we might be waiting for ice to clear to get out. Sometimes we'll get in, and the ice reports will show us that the ice movement ahead is closing the way, and we need to leave again as soon as we've arrived. So there are a lot of small communities along the way that we do hope to visit. There's probably about 10 in the Canadian Arctic. And we'll be stopping in Alaska, Dutch Harbor, which is where the Discovery show Deadliest Catch is shot from, if anybody of you watched that. That's shot in wintertime. It'll be much, much nicer when we're there. But, yeah, we do plan to stop off quite a bit. Raphael?
Hi, I'm Raphael Minda. I'm a colleague of Cameron's. It's actually a follow-up to this question. First, a really basic point, language-wise, to speak to the communities. Do Inuits, how easy is it going to get the feel of the actual local people? And second, you did mention at the start that one of the original trips took 3 years. You have 7 weeks. So follow-up to that, really. How much time can you devote to just getting a move on versus maybe taking the time to, let's say, break the ice literally with people and getting a good feel for what they're like and what shapes their life?
On the language question, vast majority of people speak English. I've been a bit concerned about that, and the more I'm looking into it, a lot of the older people do speak Inuit still. We have a sponsor called Canadian North, which is a northern airline company, and they are going to be helping introduce us into a lot of these communities, and they are the lifeline for these communities getting in and out of the Arctic. And so they have a very good name, a very good reputation, a lot of these people. They are also owned by the Aboriginals. So they're going to be an introduction. So when we do need translation, we are going to be looking at them, but we expect that English is going to suffice for a lot of it. On the timing to how much time we'll have to speak to these people, there's 6 weeks that the Northwest Passage itself is sort of open, if you want to call it open. I mean, open means that there's gaps in the ice to get through. The entire project is 4 months. We're leaving Victoria June 6th and hoping to get into Halifax at the end of September, early October. So those 6 weeks will be, that is the core of the Northwest Passage. That is coming from Bering Strait and then into Davis Strait. It's not as much time as we'd like, of course not. We're going to have to make the best of what we have. And like I say, some communities will have a week, and some communities will have a few days. And as far as the sailing time goes, I mean, 6 weeks is more than enough to get through there. There'll definitely be times when there's people we wish we could talk to and we won't have time to. But the alternative is flying in and living in, staying in some of the communities, which is very good. A lot of people have done that. Or staying on some of the Coast Guard icebreakers and doing reporting from there. And a lot of reporters go up and do that. The Globe and Mail will send somebody up for a few weeks, or CBC, Peter Mansbridge did a big series recently. But I think that the fact that we're sailing our own small, very vulnerable boat through the Arctic, through the Northwest Passage, this is an integral part of the story. And this is part of the adventure and what we hope will draw people into the story. And so there is some downside to that, yes. And that is that we're not as flexible with our time as someone that flies up, stays in Cambridge Bay, and stays with the family there and just travels around by bush plane visiting communities. No, definitely not. But they don't have the story of sailing a private yacht through the Arctic. And that's what we hope will counter that. Now, you mentioned the first trip through taking 3 years. Things have changed a lot since then, and there's a lot less ice now, and so that's we're hoping that'll allow us a bit more time to spend in communities.
David.
Yeah, as you've rightly pointed out, this is absolutely insane. How are you financing it? I can't imagine somebody's just going to write you a check and say, go off and do this.
No, they haven't, trust me. We're trying to get some sponsorship together. We have raised some sponsorship dollars. We've raised quite a bit of sponsorship in kind, as far as there's a Hong Kong sale loft that's made our sales for half price, things like this. We have a Texas utility company, of all things, sponsoring us, because one of the executives on the team is a guy that grew up on a cattle farm half a mile from me in Manitoba. The money is coming from very strange quarters that way, but sponsorship has been absolutely brutal. There's very, very little money out there. There was a National Post article on this a couple weeks ago that featured our expedition on how difficult it is to raise money. We're still looking for sponsors. We think that the expedition offers sponsors a pretty good opportunity because it's an interesting story. You have filmmakers and photographers and writers on board that can produce material for you. I mean, we're selling ourselves the best we can and trying to find companies that see the value in joining up with us, and, you know, having us come do their dinner talks afterwards, whatever it takes to bring in some money. Right now I'm financing out of my own pocket and through some very generous bank managers. And we do have a little bit of financing. There is a party on April 2nd at a club called Philia. Please come. Please drink lots. Please buy raffle tickets and help raise money. That's one way we're raising money. April 2nd, there's a big party. And there's more information on the website on that as well. But we're doing everything. I mean, I haven't started baking cookies yet, but I'm going to soon.
As we were surveying the crowd earlier, Cameron did ask, so are there any wealthy industrialists in here? I said, wrong club, Nate. That's the Hong Kong club. Question in the back.
Yeah, hi. A sailing question for you. Prevailing weather systems that time of year, are you going to be able to sail? Are you going to have to motor? And also, I didn't quite... Maybe my geography's not so good at the west coast of Canada, judging by my accent, obviously. But you're starting from effectively down in the south. You're going to have to go all the way around the top of Alaska, four people in a 40-foot boat, or five knots... You know, you've got quite a long way to cover in fairly open and aggressive waters before you actually get into the relatively sheltered area of the passage. Just some sailing thoughts on how you've planned your strategy and sort of the what-ifs around that.
Definitely. I'm just going to put up the chart just so people can see it again. Hang on.
The boat has a very large engine. So it's not very large by motor yacht, but it's a 40 horsepower diesel engine. Winds tend to be northwesterlies. Prevailing northwesterlies. So quite comfortable quarter. It'll be on our quarter. But the winds are quite unpredictable, and you'll go everything from gale back down to dead calm. And everybody I've spoken to, and I've spoken to quite a few people that have done this in the past. I'm not the first to do this. I mean, there's 100 and some transits in history, and I think 35 private boats have done it. And of those, maybe 20 of them were sailing yachts. So in the last 100 years, 35 guys like me have done this. They all say the same thing. Sail when you can, but you're going to be motor sailing sometimes to beat the ice. Yes, going up the inside passage, so from the start in Victoria, basically going up until you see the sharp turn to the west, that is called the inside passage. It's some of the most beautiful sailing in the Americas. It's along the mountains, in amongst the islands, and it's a lot of protected waters. This is where it'll be the cruise shakedown cruise, I guess, basically. It'll take us a couple of weeks, and we're going to take our time. We're leaving a bit early. And I'm doing that in order to, where you see we head west, that's Prince Rupert, right near Prince Rupert, around there. Hoping to put into Prince Rupert and stop off there for a bit, fix anything that's broke, readjust everything that needs adjusting, and then across the Gulf of Alaska. And that'll be a pretty frolicking good sail, I reckon. I talked to a guy that did it a couple of years ago. He did it the other way around. So he came across the Gulf of Alaska in October, and they got hammered. I'm expecting it'll be a bit better, but I'm expecting to get hammered coming down the other side. So it'll be very, very difficult sailing some of it, especially coming down the East Coast at the end of the summer. But I'm confident in the boat. You step on aboard her, and she instills confidence in you, I tell you. She's solid, very, very sturdy rig, and brand new sails, and we'll do the best we can.
Cameron, with respect to the sovereignty issue, you mentioned that Canada likes to keep track of who's sailing through their passage, and you've, I guess, has your notification been through this to ship captain? Was that your notification to Canada? Do you have a similar procedure as you're going through Alaskan waters? Do you have to notify the U.S. Coast Guard? Do the Danes get involved on the other side?
I'm registering with NORDREG, which is a voluntary Canadian registration system. It becomes compulsory next year. This is a very big part of Canada's argument why these are Canadian waters, and it's been interesting where countries that dispute Canada's sovereignty here, however, will come to NORDREG and register with them to come through, which is an interesting thing to do in international waters if you don't recognize the sovereignty. So I'm registering with NORDREG. Coast Guard is very well aware of my plans. It was rather, humbling or nerve-wracking when I met with Captain Snyder, and he told me, oh, yeah, we've been aware of your project for a while. He goes, we've been watching it. I'm like, really? I said, I've only been in touch with NORDREG like a week ago. And this was last week when I met with him. And he goes, yeah, he goes, come December, he goes, all our researchers, all the Coast Guard researchers start getting online and Googling Arctic expedition, Arctic sailing. He goes, we want to find out what kind of nutters are out there every year. And so he was he was aware of it, and he'd been kind of, they were aware of what my plans were. And so I'm registering with them. I'll definitely be keeping the Alaskan Coast Guard aware of, or the American Coast Guard aware of what we're doing as well. Denmark, don't know, not going that far north. But as far as the sovereignty thing goes, this is a Canadian expedition. It's a Canadian registered boat. There's two Canadians on board. We're not going up there to do any kind of crazy flag waving. We're not going to put a flag on the North Pole. But I am very proud to be flying a Canadian flag up there because this is part of Canada. And I think this is part of the story. And I'm, I certainly want to remain objective about it. But I'm very proud that this is going to be a Canadian expedition in Canadian waters.
Sure you're not going to plant the maple leaf in Alaska somewhere? Governor Palin isn't looking?
Well, I like to think after this, if anybody at FCC wants to have me come in and talk about Russian economics or anything like this, I reckon I should be considered an expert because I will be sailing very close to Russia. And
yes. Russell in the back, and then Edith.
Cameron, I admire you immensely, but in tribute of our time together on the business desk, let's talk some numbers here. First off, in a perfect world, what's it going to cost you to make this trip? Okay, how much of that do you actually have? Okay, and secondly, what are the odds of you actually making this on schedule?
Budget, including some new camera gear for the expedition, is around $125,000 Canadian. That's very low. Anybody that's done expeditions raises their eyebrows at that. And there's a reason for that. Being a good Mennonite boy from the prairies of Manitoba, I have humble ambitions. When I started out on this, I didn't imagine it was going to become kind of this big, I guess. And I'm glad now that I started out with a very conservative estimate because of the economic situation. It's very, very hard raising money. So at the end of the day, we are going. There's absolutely no way we are not going for economic reasons. I'm in the midst of remortgaging my flat here in Hong Kong. I've borrowed money from my family. I've, shook out my penny jar. We're going. But the budget might get cut back a bit. I don't know. If no other sponsors step forward, we will have to cut back. But it'll be cutting back on some things that can be cut back on, which would be ideal to have part of the expedition. But, we will go, and we will go safely. So far, I've raised about $35,000 Canadian in sponsorship support. That's in kind and in cash donations. And what are the chances that we're not going there? We're going. I mean,
you'll go on schedule.
Oh, on schedule. I think they're pretty good odds. I'm leaving here in the beginning of May. It gives me a month in Victoria to do last-minute preparations. That includes my oldest brother, who used to build boats for the Lake Winnipeg fishing fleets. He's coming out over to Victoria and helping me put stainless steel on the bow. We're doing a refit that's being started right now. I was just in Victoria last week. We have a lot of stuff to do still, but I'm pretty confident that come June 6th, we're going to push off. I think we're going to make it.
Edith in the front.
Hi, Cameron. I never had the privilege of editing your copy, but I want to take sort of an editor's perspective on this. You're talking about doing climate change as the basic story, and the plan is to stop in, if you can, to these 10 ports. Now, my experience is limited to Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk, but both of those are very tiny communities that have fascinating people, but it takes a lot of time to get them to sort of tell their stories, kind of sift through different types of people. And the ones who are going to be noticing the impact of climate change are already in kind of a minority, I would say, in those communities, until you talk about things perhaps like seal ranges or something like that. But how are you going to get into that level of detail and have it meaningfully scientific? I wish you'd talk a little bit more about that.
On the last thing you mentioned, meaningfully scientific, I mean, I think, I just want to touch that first. A lot of adding the meaningful scientific background will happen later. Obviously, we'll go up there and hear the stories, and then kind of put them into the bigger picture later on. This is a constant concern of mine, how much time we're going to get up there and how we're going to break into these communities. And I realize that these communities tend to be fairly closed to outsiders sometimes because there's a joke going there, there's a common joke that every Inuit family has five people in it. There's a mother, a father, two kids, and an anthropologist. And that is, I mean, there's so many scientists up there, and they are getting a bit tired of it. I know that. But I do think that having spoken to the people that live up there and the people that have gone through and have spent time up there, they do think things like, what I mentioned before, Canadian North. I mean, having somebody like that coming in and introducing us into the communities, that will help. Getting in contact with as many people as we can up there. I mean, if you have any contacts up there, I'd love to get them to, so we have that, so we have people that know we're coming and can kind of introduce us to people. But that's the problem every time you're on a reporting trip. I mean, any time you go off on a story trip, any journalist knows that you never get enough time in every town to get to really kind of get everything you want. And it'll be the same challenge, I mean, and it will be a challenge. And at the end of the day, I know that we'll come home and say, man, I wish we could have spent more time talking to that guy. We never really got to know that guy, that he probably had a good story. There will be those cases, but I don't really know any other way around it. Besides going and spending an awful lot of time up there beforehand and then sailing through, and I don't have that luxury.
Was there, I think, one last question in the back here?
Hi, Graham Ernst. In terms of the odds, so it's a 100% chance that you're going to leave, 99% chance that you're going to leave on June 6th. What are the odds that you and your crew get to Halifax in good health?
I'm telling him it's 100% chance. I think the chances are pretty good. I mean, anytime you go sailing offshore, it's dangerous. If you're sailing from here to the Philippines in the South China Sea race, it's dangerous. And these are pretty easy waters, really. If you go out for a day sail, it's dangerous. I mean, there's an element of danger that is unavoidable. But as far as getting trapped in the ice conditions at the moment are looking like 2009 will be on par with 2008. 2008, six boats made it through. Six private yachts made it through. That was the most in history. But yet, 2008 conditions from a sailing perspective were not as good as 2007, meaning there was more ice in 2008 than there was in 2007. But if we're on par for 2008, our odds are very, very good. As far as ice conditions go, I think we've got a pretty good chance. And again, I mean, I don't want to base too much on this interview I had with Captain Snyder, but we've been emailing quite a bit and then had a chance to sit down for a couple hours and chat with him. And And he had taken quite a bit of time to look through the site and examine our plans and stuff, and he really instilled a bit of confidence in me in saying that, he said, I see no reason, you know, he goes, I think that you're well prepared. You guys have a very good chance of making it through in one season. There is a chance we won't. There's an outside chance that we'll get caught up in ice and have to leave the boat somewhere, like Cambridge Bay, which would be very bad, but we'll deal with that, I guess. I mean, that would mean we'd have to go back up next summer again, and I'd have to quit another job.
I'm sure the FT will have you back. Cameron, thanks for a really fascinating talk. As is customary, we have a little gift for the speaker. It's a little bit uncustomary. We have an FCC life jacket here for you. Please join me in thanking Cameron. And if you check the website, there'll be details there of your fundraiser on April 2nd,
yep,
right?
April 2nd, Philia Lounge in Central.
And you can track the voyage as it happens this summer on the website.
And also, I mean, I threw an offhand comment in there about taking commissions for freelance. I'm serious. I mean, I'm looking for work this summer, and I'll be looking for work when I come back. So if there's anybody out there that's interested in some stories from the Arctic, bring me up.
Yes, so we have to report this report.